Hi, Radicals, and thanks for tuning in. This is Sam here from the Radical Writing Podcast. Some of these texts stretch content as experimentally as they do form, and this is a heads up that some episodes feature discussions of a particularly sensitive nature. For example, we may be reading and then elaborating on extracts which feature swearing, violence, and sexual content. And discussions will be compassionate and empathetic, but also, in order to accurately reflect the text, explicit. Engaging with these challenging topics is often key to the author's technique and central to the story they're telling. But they can be difficult subjects to discuss and listen to. Listen for the trigger warnings at the start of the episode, and if you prefer to avoid that episode, do check out another one from the series. And if you think that the series as a whole may not be suitable for you, that's okay too. If you are comfortable listening on, now is the time to pop your headphones on or to find a private space. And as a heads up, the following text contains some discussion of violence and execution. Hello, Radicals, and welcome to the weird and wonderful literary world of the Radical Writing Podcast, the series dedicated to the best in contemporary, experimental, or innovative writing. This is episode 2, Susan Howe's Icon Basilica, or A Bibliography of the King's Book. My name is Sam Kemp, and I'll be your host. I'm a poet and lecturer in creative writing. Today, my guest is Rebecca Newby, and we've both chosen a favourite poem and prepared some questions for one another. A Bibliography of the King's Book, or Icon Basilica, is a 1989 poetry collection by Susan Howe. It's about, and to a certain degree, is itself a book of treaties, meditations, prayers, and tracts attributed to King Charles I, named Icon Basilica. The original was published and distributed on the day of his execution in 1649, but is now considered to be a forgery, the real authors being anonymous sympathizers to the royalist cause. Howe's response centers on an 1896 bibliography of Icon Basilica by Edward Almanac, and her poetry is part homage and part appropriation. It's a collection which fits within the language poetry genre, with a particular emphasis on fragmented and visual forms, a shifting voice and a striking sense of typology and materialism. It poses questions of authorship, form, and language, and is a pivotal text for experimental artists in both visual and written mediums, as well as academics and critics of radical writing. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name's Rebecca. As Sam said, I'm an assistant professor in English at Northeastern University London. I mainly teach writing, as well as our Cultures of London course. But actually, my background is in medieval literature. So I suppose I'm a controversial choice for a podcast dealing with radical, experimental postmodern poetry, and yet here I am.
And yet here you are. You're about a thousand years behind where the most of the texts that feature on the Radical Writing Podcast. But that is exactly why I wanted you here. So thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome. I'm excited to be here, and I hope I can shed some new light on these poems by talking about them through the lens of my background in medieval poetry.
Fantastic, I'm sure you will. So I'm going to jump right in with my favourite poem. It is difficult to find a favourite poem in this particular collection. We have one hallowed collection between the two of us because this particular text is the least accessible of the texts in the series, and I'll explore a little bit about where you can see it though. So this poem doesn't have a name, but it does not even have a page number. So I'm just going to go right from the top. I should also say before I read it that the words are all over the page. So there are lines at various angles. There's vertical lines, upside down lines, horizontal lines, everywhere and anywhere. The exact order of how you read it is certainly debatable. I'm just going to kind of give it a go and we'll see what happens. Crucified by ordinance, that sea of blood, the malicious author or instigator, fort, navy, militia, tract the treasons, throw down, always causes set down for a different message. O make me of joy some passage, thrown on this person an intellectualist. Was taken a pivot through populace, through the populace, the people contemporary history. Strive against starry scruples at times, he bowed down his head and his in a low voice, the people. that I hide security and their security, and wall, the brazen wall, I am weary of life, pretend justice to cover perjury. The sentiment goes peers, ferrets to the last, obligation steps between prisons. Obligation steps between prisons, I am weary of life, pretend justice to cover perjury. And wall, the brazen wall, the sentiment goes peers, ferrets to the last, that I hide security and their security, strive against starry scruples at times. He bowed down his head and said, the people, in a low voice, contemporary history, a pivot through the populacy, was taken, thrown on this person, an intellectualist, for a different message. Some passages, oh, make me of joy, always causes set down, the malicious author or instigator, fort, navy, militia, tracked the treasons, throw down, crucified by ordinance, that sea of blood. This is definitely not a light poem. This is a serious, heavy-duty poem. Every single word is absolute. And that's kind of part of the reason why I love it, and part of the reason why I love talking about this particular collection.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has such strength and such kind of sincerity to it, even if it is kind of everyday language.
Sincerity?
I'd say sincerity, yeah.
I'm just going to pick you up on that word. Why sincerity?
An everydayness, I think, to the language.
Yes, okay.
An honesty. So, yeah, an honesty to the speaker.
Okay. A sense of real immediacy, then.
I think immediacy.
Yes.
Miniature narratives. In right. That kind of immediacy that's created. I mean, the...
Trying to break down the act of writing, or the translation of the mundane, of the real, of reality into the writing.
I think so.
In that way.
I think so. You may be above me there.
I'm thinking out loud.
No.
I just found that sincerity, or your use of the word sincerity, interesting.
Mm.
To me, it feels, when you're reading, there's a mundaneness there. The way that the text, the display of the text, slows you down inevitably, because you can't just read in the way that we're used to, from left to right, from line to line. You have to turn the book around, and and your listeners won't be able to see, but you are literally turning the book in your hands, turning your head to read the next line.
Yeah.
And it really slows you down, and it makes it kind of almost plodding. But at the same time, it was putting me on edge almost, because there's a violence to some of the words being used.
Mm-hmm.
I
think that's a good way of putting it. There's a violence to some of the words being used, that the sea of blood, crucified by ordinance. And I should also sort of go back and talk about the framing of the collection that we already have kind of going up to this. But I'll do that in a minute. But yeah, I think you're right. I think there is a violence to the words, and a violence to the jagged angles that they form on the page. Quite literally jagged. The whole thing looks like it could be a kind of a scrap heap pile of rusty metal.
Right. I mean, it looks like... I don't know if you've ever done that at all, where you cut up words and sentences and lines and throw them around for some sort of activity. I can't think of one off the top of my head. But that's how it looks on the page, certainly.
I think that's exactly what a lot of Hal's processes are. And I think they're sort of so simple and so magical at the same time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So part of the reason why I like it is because we have a mirroring going on. So the first half of the poem is the same as the second half, but it mirrors you could imagine a kind of horizontal line going between those two sections, but on the page it's presented as a vertical line. That would make more sense if you could find those poems. They're a little hard to find, but that kind of mirroring I think is quite nice. There's a neatness to it, a striving to control.
How paradoxical.
And how paradoxical.
We've just talked about how messy and jagged it is, and now you're talking about neatness.
Messy, I think it's messy and jagged within a container. It's contained by the
like
page.
Like a box of lines that you've shaken up.
Held, yet able to fall wherever it is. It's a contradiction. Yeah,
yes.
It's a beautiful contradiction. So I like that mirroring. And then I think the last thing that I'll highlight about this particular one is that a few pages later on, again, these are unpaginated, a few pages later on, there's a section of that poem which is just kind of pasted below ordinary prose lines. And Howe does this a lot throughout the book and in a lot of her other texts as well. There will just be regular prose lines after lines after lines with full stops and everything else. And quite often they're in a different tone, a different voice. This one sounds, this one begins, for example, England's Black Tribunal containing the complete trial of King Charles the First by the pretended High Court of Justice in Westminster Hall began January 20th, 1648. So it's kind of like a little bit of a history lesson that we have. And then suddenly the words skew and violently just jagged down into the open page, and it forms this beautiful but unpredictable collection of phrases. And some of the poem is repeated there. Now, the thing that I took from that, and I'd be kind of intrigued to see if you got this as well, is again, that sense of order that we have. We're used to words going from following words, sentences following sentences. We're not used to them literally being then jaggedly thrown off the cliff into the wide space. I took that to be the act of execution, that we have order, we have stability, and then we have that the guillotine kind of coming down mm-hmm. and removing the head, the violence.
Would it have been a guillotine at this?
Actually, as I say that, I don't know. I'm not sure.
That sounds very French to me.
It does sound very French. It does sound very French.
I thought he was beheaded with...
with a sword? Or
with
a
sword?
We'll let the historians, I think, come in on that, yeah.
We really should have looked this up beforehand to make this more historicist. okay, that's interesting. That's interesting. And I have a sort of... I certainly think that's happening in the text, although I'm not sure, I'm not convinced that that is what it represents. When I talk about my favourite passage, I'm going to give you a slightly different reading.
Go for it.
But before I get there, I just wanted to say, thinking about some of these lines carrying over into other pages, I first came to Susan Howe in... about coming up 10 years ago now, how frightening, 2013, 2014, when I was doing my master's at Cardiff University. And I had a great lecturer there, and I was one of only three people on the experimental writing module. And although my primary interest was in medieval literature, I was also really interested in this kind of language poetry and experimental writing. Anyway, among other poets, he introduced us to Susan Howe, and I read and actually wrote on Howe's Souls of the Labadee Tract, which is her more of a personal narrative from what I recall. Mm. Although it must be said I don't recall that much. It's quite some time ago now. But one of the things I remember from the paper I wrote on it was that an image that recurs through Howe's writing is this of, or idea, I should say, is of a lost or a wanderer lost in a kind of wilderness of language, of archives, bits of legend, bits of history, and words. And this is kind of what I see here is happening. And she mentions, there are a few mentions of the Theseus myth and of the Greek myth of Ariadne leading Theseus through the labyrinth. And we see, that was my second favourite actually, much later on in here, there are lots of references to Ariadne. And I see Howe as a kind of Ariadne figure here, leading with these broken bits of text, leading the threads of text, I should say, in keeping with the legend, leading the reader or the audience through this performance of history and text and bits and pieces. Because, of course, it's not all just historical here. There's also references to fiction, to Shakespeare, among other things. And that's kind of what I see that as a symptom of that, of this thread of language.
I think that's such a beautiful way of putting it, and I love the idea of the author as Ariadne sort of being led round and following these strings of...
Ariadne is the one that lays the thread.
Gotcha.
In the myth. She lays the golden thread, I should explain that, sorry, for Theseus So he can find his way to the centre of the labyrinth and, of course, to the Minotaur, which in that legend is something that he has to defeat. Of course, the centre here is Charles I. And the royal image, right? But part of the point, or not point, that's too reductive, but it seems to me that one of the things that Howe is trying to show here is that there is no royal image at the centre. There is, it's a kind of absent centre. And this is a kind of recovery process, but of history, of that real king, but there isn't anything to recover. And I've made that sound quite nihilistic almost, but actually I don't think it is. I think it's, I'm going on a bit here now, sorry, but I think it reveals something about the nature of historical discourse itself, which is to say that sometimes there isn't a single centre, a single image, a coherent story to be revealed from historical documentation.
I think that's a beautiful summary of Howe. And I'm, as you can probably tell, I am a huge, huge fan of Susan Howe and all of her collections. And this one in particular seemed like a kind of prototypical one in the way that it's set out. I think it's right that we start talking about process so early on, because it's a collection which you are just bombarded by the author's, the artist's process throughout and kind of invited into that particular process. One thing that you mentioned is recovery, which I think is wonderful. And it strikes me that's a lovely way of coming into Howe's work as a recovery of a particular thing. And that recovery is not so much a putting together of the jigsaw pieces. It seems to be a kind of blasting apart of the jigsaw pieces. And I'm kind of reminded of that idea of the real itself and the true facts of the case, or the true facts of whatever may be in the archives, are actually better explored or better reflected or better interrogated via fragmentation, via literally scattering things on the page rather than attempting to put them together.
And this is a really nice segue into my favourite page of the book.
Go for it.
I'm just going to return to that before we move the discussion too far on. So my favourite page actually, incidentally, comes just before the poem that you chose. It's another of Howe's very graphic pages in this book.
A beautiful one as well. Like, it's worth kind of saying these are visually stunning in their proportion and the way they're put together.
And this is part of the reason that I chose it. So I'm going to attempt to read it now, just so you guys, you listeners, can hear it, but I would really recommend looking up online, and you can, I was able to find this on Google Images, so you can see these individual poetic portraits, if you like, even if you can't access the entire text very easily. Okay. Icon Basilica. Language of state secrets, the pretended court of justice, upon the picture of His Majesty sitting his chair before the High Court of Injustice. Small trespass to Miss Prison, now non-existent, dramatis personae, confront each other. Heroic virtue and fame steps between prison and grave, a brazen wall, the first. Bradshaw went on in a long harangue, misapplying law and history. Okay.
Lovely. And I love how you're having to turn the page, turn
yes,
the book.
It's interesting to watch,
it.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's Howe's intention, right? She wants you to be an active participant in the act of reading and experiencing the text rather than just passively receiving it, right?
Recovering it in some way, yeah.
Right, exactly. You're also within this process of recovery as well. Interesting. I'll just say before we go any further that the last two lines I read are, I'd say, in a more sort of in an almost clearer way than the ones you read. They are given or presented vertically, but you can turn the book to read them, right? So it's not, it's worth explaining that, I think.
Yeah,
it's not
yeah.
the letters are given vertically, like Chinese characters, for example. It's that the line is, what's the word? Given in the horizontal.
Well, it's
in not port in landscape mode.
Yes, finally
got there. I was trying to think back to Microsoft Word there to get the word.
And it's also literally struck through the heart of the poem as we take the poem to be.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in addition to that, there are two horizontal block lines, which underline justice. First,
and
then the second one underlines injustice.
Yeah.
And the title of this poem, Icon Basilica, we don't have a page number again, but the title is given with a full stop, but it is not underlined and it is in capital letters with some old Greek characters as well. Yeah, I just think it's beautiful to look at. The reason this one interested me in particular is because, more so than the others, it is an image. It's a kind of crisscross image, almost in a frame, framed by these different lines, intersecting lines. And so in a way, more so than any of the other pages I've looked at in this, it sums up the paradox of this text in that it is both iconic, it is the royal image, but because of the intersecting lines which cross over other words and lines, it is also iconoclastic. So it is both producing the image but also smashing up an image simultaneously. And that's why I really like it the most. The other thing I find very interesting about this is that in another edition of this text, and I think it was I can't remember the name of the edition. Nonconformist something.
Okay.
It basically was this poem was put, or this larger poem was put into a collection with other poets.
Right.
And in that edition, the word justice, which is on the third line of this one, this edition, this copy, has an additional I. It's misspelt, J-U-S-T-double-I-C-E. Here it's just got the one I. But in the misspelt version, the first or second I is given without the dot, like a decapitated I.
Gotcha.
Which is exactly the kind of thing which sparks my interest in this kind of poetry, where the layout, the display of the poem, somehow reflects the real image, the real historical image that actually is given on the front of this copy. We have some sort of lino print, or do you know what this is?
Sort of sketch.
Yeah, of the execution.
And no guillotine. So that
no, it looks
that.
Like an axe, actually.
I think I love the fact that you've chosen this piece, and I'm really glad you have. I think it introduces the collection in such a good way. And like you say, I think that's such a lovely way of putting it. It's a portrait in itself. It's a visually stunning portrait, and one that is skewered through, one that is, in a way, kind of decapitated, maybe, by some of those lines. I also love the fact that how is a poet, a language poet, where we can talk so much about the absence or presence of one single letter. You know, she has this ability to distill language to such a degree that every single sound, every single word carries the ultimate kind of weight. And
right.
I think maybe that's a better idea as to what I was getting at with sincerity. There's a kind of sincerity of language, although craft is quite clearly here and worn on the sleeve, I guess, in a way. We can kind of see the poetic craft, but it's more subtle than, say, in a sonnet or in a kind of set form. And that's kind of reductive comparing this to a sonnet. But yeah, there's a sort of sincerity, I think, around the nature of also what you're saying around content and form,
mm-hmm.
how the form is so, so sincere and reflective of the content of the king of this book, which is a ghostly book. And you mentioned earlier on, what is the center here? It is the ghost of a king. And that's actually a line that's directly
That's what she says at the end of the introduction. Yes, exactly. Yes.
I think it's a beautiful piece. Yeah. I wanted to pick up on, I think, language of state secrets. Feels really, really lovely. But this is the bit which felt like a wonderful introduction and also a wonderful use of exposition in a way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this poem was, I'd like to think it was kind of written later, perhaps when Howe was kind of through the project, when it was developed. And this is putting it at the beginning and subtly getting across what the collection is. Small trespass to Miss Prison, now non-existent dramatis personae confront each other. Heroic virtue, fame. Is she saying that these, the pages right in front of us that we're holding, where finally the dramatis personae can confront each other? It's a kind of afterlife of the characters, afterlife of the historical figures, afterlife of their language, and the book that is attempting to capture that, the icon Basilica. This is the arena, this is the space in which they're going to confront each other. And by each other, it is royalists and, I've forgotten the term.
Roundheads.
Royalist roundheads, yeah. Cromwell.
Well, the parliamentarians.
And parliamentarians,
you could call them, yes.
Yeah. What a noble yet difficult space to create.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. I've kind of jumped on your poem there.
No, that's okay.
Do you want to jump in with a question at this point?
Yeah, I suppose, and this follows on nicely from what you were just saying, this kind of collapsing of history into fiction and art, which Howe seems to be engaging with or enacting.
Enacting is a good way of putting
enacting.
It. Yeah,
yeah. Do you think that she, you know, obviously she clearly has an interest in history and historical figures and collecting up bits of legend, historical artifact, archive, and recovering absences or voices that have been marginalised. And that's certainly something I remember from my reading around her and other poets who became part of the language tradition. But I wonder whether she was aware that this kind of mixing or collapsing of different discourses, disciplines, is somewhat pre-modern in that medieval writers, storytellers, and storytellers predominantly, often fail to keep those two things distinct. So for example, medieval poets would often claim that their material was historical, in order to gain greater authority, authenticity. So this is something that's already been happening for a long time. And I wondered whether you know if Howe is aware of that, whether she's engaging in that longer tradition rather than doing something that's only postmodern. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and exactly why I wanted you on. So part of the reason why we're looking at this text is because in the staff room, I think I was reading it and you happened to be around and looked over my shoulder and we had a discussion about medieval literature and how visually there's some crossovers here.
That's definitely a different point that we could come on to after you respond to the Howe point, but I suppose perhaps you're not sure.
Well, my response is that, yeah, I'm not sure. I think I know that she, in quite a few of her collections, this is part of the reason why I love her so much, is that she's not necessarily writing for the now. I think we can absolutely dig so much of the now into it, but she just has this wonderful ability and kind of, I don't know, confidence. She's just writing about things that she finds of curiosity, and quite often they are things from the past.
I think the reason I brought it up is in my, I recall from, I admittedly haven't done enough reading around this particular text, but I recall from when I was doing my work on her and poets like Lynn Hajinian, about 10 years ago, that there's often this kind of opposition set up between what these postmodern experimental poets are doing and what was done traditionally in relation to poetry, literature, writing about history and all of that kind of stuff. I was interested, that's part of the reason I ended up doing studying medieval literature in the way that I did, which is looking at fragmentary medieval texts, is thinking about how the two might be related and might not be oppositional in the way that perhaps they seem to be. So I think that's something perhaps we could pursue.
Can you tell us more about it now? I love the fragment. I love how and the fragment. And yeah. I think it's worth sort of saying every single line, except for there are some more prosaic sections, every single line is a fragment in itself.
Yeah, of course.
Is that there's medieval precedence?
I will struggle to summarize my years of research in a soundbite, but I think a good takeaway for your listeners is that it's when I talk about fragmentary medieval poems in this context, I am by no means saying that the medieval writers were sitting down to write fragmentary texts in the way that postmodern poets or postmodern writers would. It's more that sometimes because of the medieval or some medieval poet's style of writing and approach to writing in a kind of discursive way, sometimes they would introduce multiple viewpoints, multiple perspectives, and too many perspectives, too many viewpoints. Sometimes the poems, the stories, and they were stories then, poems were always narrative, would grow outwards in a way that couldn't be brought to an easy conclusion. Mm. So I suppose it's not that you should equate the two, not at all. But there is a dialogue there to be had, I think. The reason that we had that discussion you mentioned earlier was something different, and it was more to do with the visual aspect of the poetry.
Susan, I should say, like, Susan Howe is a visual artist as well as a poet, and you can absolutely see that in the work.
Yes, so I'm really interested in her, even more so now, in her the kind of graphic display of the poem, because I recently, in the last couple of years, have written quite a bit about Geoffrey Chaucer. Some of you hopefully may have heard of him. He's a very famous 14th century English poet, often called the father of English poetry, in fact. So very important bloke.
And radical in his own right.
He was. Yeah. He really was. He was one of the first to write in English, poetry in English in that way. And recover the English language for artistic purposes. So very important, even in this context. He wrote a very famous text called The Canterbury Tales, which was the last thing he wrote before his death in 1400. And it is a collection of more than 20 different poems told by various characters who are on a pilgrimage to Canterbury, hence the name The Canterbury Tales. Anyway, I could talk for hours about that, but I just wanted to talk about one particular poem in that collection, which is called The Tale of Sir Topas. And Sir Topas is a parody of what a medieval knight might look like in the 14th century. And Sir Topas is not a serious knight. Although he might think he's a serious knight. Have you ever watched any Monty Python?
Oh, yes.
Hopefully, I don't know how young these listeners are, but Monty Python is quite famous, or was very famous, 20th century comedy show and series of films. Mm. And in one of them, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, they lampoon all things to do with King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, and it's absolutely hilarious. And one of the characters, do you remember Sir Robin? Rides through the forest being absolutely useless at everything to do with being a knight. He can't do anything. He can't defend himself. He certainly can't defend others. He just rides around on his fake horse trying to look pretty. It's all very silly. And that's kind of what Sir Topas is like. He's completely ineffectual as a knight. He can't do anything. He can't fight the giant he encounters. He can't make the fairy queen, who he loves, fall in love with him. It's all very silly. Anyway, that was a very quick introduction to the poem, because it's important here in that in the 15th century, predominantly, but in some of the late 14th century copies of the poem, because, of course, in the Middle Ages, you're not looking at printing, or certainly, I think early 15th century you might have been, but earlier on anyway, it was all manuscripts, so everything had to be copied by hand. Mm. And in the early copies, in some of the early copies of this poem, it is written in a visual, or it is presented in a visual way. So Sir Topas is an example of a tale rhyme romance, and that means that it had... it's a type of bob and wheel. I won't get into all the ins and outs of that now. But essentially, you've got to imagine that there were lines there are stanzas of couplets, or maybe three lines rhymed together, triplets, followed by a shorter, unrhymed line, which was known as the tale. Sir Topas, Chaucer adds some random single syllable or single stress lines, I should say, as well as the unrhymed tail rhyme lines. Mm. It's a mouthful. And some of these scribes, whether this was Chaucer's intention, we don't know. It could have just been a creative scribe or a bunch of creative scribes. They copied the tail rhymes and the bob lines to the right of the standard lines. So what you end up with, and it's hard to explain without seeing it on the page, and I encourage people to go away and look this up, again in Google Images, very handy. It will be there. It ends up looking like, it was described by a famous critic, Helen Cooper, as kind of like the schedule for a tennis tournament. So you have the main poem, and then you have these unrhymed lines to the right.
Brilliant.
Of the main poem. The tail rhymes in a second column to the main poem, and then these single stress bob lines further again to the right.
So does this mean that I can say that visual poetry has medieval
it precedence? Does. Yes, it does.
I love that.
And even though it wasn't common, actually I've found, and others have found in their research, that this was something that was happening with tail rhyme poetry going back to the Anglo-Norman period in the 12th century. So there was a tradition for this. Chaucer wasn't the first to do this.
Okay.
And you also see this in liturgical verse poems and a number of other different forms. Mm. So graphic displays of poems were happening as early as the 12th century.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. And in the case of Sir Topas, it's intended, I think, to amplify the joke.
Okay.
Because a bit like we have in Susan Howe here, it makes it really hard or much harder to read that poem or to know what order to read the poem in. A bit like you don't really know how to read Topas, the character itself. He doesn't know whether he's coming or going. He sort of just rides, gallops around haphazardly around this forest in the story.
So there's that kind of near perfect reflection of content and form again.
Again, yeah. This reflection of content and form. But it's really interesting, and it does make me wonder, perhaps I'll write to her, whether poets like Howe are aware of this longer tradition.
Knowing Howe, I would be surprised if she wasn't.
Yes.
But I love that idea of the dialogue. And yes. I think that Howe does this in so many of her collections. She creates that dialogue. It's never, you know, I think I even used the word in the introduction here, a response. Her work is not really a response. It's never really a response. It's exactly that. It's a dialogue.
Yeah.
So I'm going to quickly ask you a question related to that, which is on form and the collection as a whole. The collection as a whole is a piece of art. And one thing that I I've always learned from how and I've always gone back to with how is the design of the collection as a whole. It feels as though none of these poems, and they are, as you say, printed individually, but when they come together, they form one giant poem, which is just absolutely stunning. And each poem you read then informs the next one and the next one and the next one. So my question for that is, we have an essay at the beginning. And the essay at the beginning goes through what you are about to read in a way. It sets you up for what we have. Mm-hmm. And I apologize if I just answered my own question, but I wondered if you had any thoughts on the role of the essay. So essentially, a few pages into the actual book, it sort of begins again. There's another kind of half copyright page which is written over by Susan Howe, and Howe's name and replaces Edward Almanac's. But I guess my question is, without that essay, would you know what's going on? Would you be able to get as much from the text as you possibly can?
I think it would be a struggle. Almost too far. Mm. And I think Howe knows that.
Yes.
Or knew that, yes, rather. Yes. It was in the 80s, I should say, knew that. Which is why she has written this. And it's not your traditional essay by any means. I mean,
no.
It has these kind of short imperative lines. Or yes, imperative lines. The icon Basilica is a forgery.
Mm,
mm. So it's also almost, yes, it is an introductory essay, but it's almost lulling the reader. It's a kind of soft opening, isn't it? It's a soft entrance to the text. It's priming them.
Yeah.
And I think, yes, I'm happy to say I would struggle without it.
Mm.
If you just had this, I mean, the first page after the essay is one of these visual poems where it's really extreme in its rearranging of letters and words. Some words are completely, the letters are mixed up. Some are written backwards, upside down. And I think that would make things very difficult for the sort of the dilettante reader especially, but really for any reader. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think it would. I think visual poets' radical work has this general challenge of how do you get so deep into the subject in that it's embedded in the form that it takes on, and yet still introduce it in a way which prepares the reader and makes sense for what it is. So I think if the poetry, like this, for example, it's going down so far into itself and into its own world that Howe has allowed it to do that and slip down away from kind of everyday sense in a way, I guess. Like, we wouldn't be able to pick up, I think, one of these poems at random. And let's just pick this page. Must lie outside the house, side of space I must cross to write against the ghost. You know, this would not, to us, say King Charles I. It wouldn't say anything about what Howe is kind of getting at there. But she's able to do that. She's able to do it, and I love that, because she says, I'm going to write whatever I like and I'm going to get right into the subject and the actual poems because I've got this essay to orientate it right at the beginning. And we can go back to it. That says all the exposition. That says all the stuff that you need to know. Let's get straight to the good stuff in the poetry. That's kind of what I took her essays to be.
Yeah, I think as well, without it, you might make the mistake of trying to look for her constantly in these visual poems.
Yeah,
when actually that's by giving us that introductory essay, she's telling us her relationship to the poem, right?
Yes.
Rather than us looking for her and looking for what she's saying about herself. And that would kind of take away from her purpose, right? But also, you know, this essay is almost just like another piece of historical documentation, isn't it?
Mm.
It's her, it's another, you know, just as much as these visual poems are, it's another bit of her contribution to this discourse. And so I think it works, it fits just fine. I think the more I talk to you, the more I think that this whole poem, this whole artwork, as you called it, is about historical discourse itself.
Mm.
It's about how this, all the bits of data, all the kind of and material and all these computer voices that she's collected together resist cohering into just one image or a legible historical narrative or legible story about Charles I. And this is part of that. This doesn't perfectly cohere, this introduction, I mean, into the rest of the poem. But that kind of is part of the point.
Rebecca, I think you've just summed up the whole text in such a wonderful way that I'm just going to let it conclude the episode
right there.
So this edition of Susan Howell's A Bibliography of the King's Book, or Icon Basilica, that we've been using is a 1989 Paradigm Press edition, of which only 1,000 were printed. So this is the most elusive book in the Radical Writing podcast series in more ways than one. And a copy has a price tag in the triple digits. However, don't despair. A Short Expert is available for free on the Poetry Foundation website. And as it's such a popular text for literary critics, you could probably piece the collection together through the various articles and reviews which cover it. And you mentioned that there's some on Google Image as well.
I'm pretty sure when you first asked me to do this, that I found some.
Great.
But I will not be held to that.
Rebecca, thank you so much for participating in the Radical Writing podcast. I'm so pleased to give you your coveted Radical Writing flag.
Wow, look at that. My cat is going to love this.
good.
Thank you, Sam.
Wave it with pride.
I will.
You have been listening to the Radical Writing podcast. A huge thank you to my guest, Rebecca Newby. And an equally huge thank you to our production team, Alistair Robinson, Mark Dutton and Rob Adie. Join us next time for episode 3, where we'll be discussing Harriet Tarlow's anthology of radical landscape poetry, Ground Aslant. And as always, stay radical.